This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, he growled, she ejaculated. Reader peeves and how to avoid them.
So this week... Sorry.
I did wonder when you would actually react to that one.
I was so calm about the whole thing until I heard you saying it out loud, and then it just became a bit too much. Anyway, so... This week is brought to you by Jules. Sorry, I have control of myself. I am an adult. Jules, what has inspired this week's episode?
I've sort of found or seen a lot of posts and things on social media and stuff about particular tics and tells that authors have in their actual writing, in that, you know, the actual writing, not so much character tropes and things, which we've obviously discussed at length, but things in the writing that trip readers up, that make them want to put the book down or make them roll their eyes or, you know, back off or skip passages, because that's a big thing, skipping through things.
Yeah.
So I thought it would be worth examining some of these things. And full disclosure, a few of these things are things that I did as a new writer or that I still do now. And then during the editing process, I have to go through and take 90% of it out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your first draft doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be finished.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so guilty of this. And anyone, I go back through The Sons of Thestian and I see so much stuff that I'd want to change now, but that's to be expected. I wrote it a long time ago. And that's okay. It's okay for you to develop, you know, your writing and to get better. And there is always going to be a certain level of cliche and pet peeves and sort of poor writing in any draft or any finished piece that you produce, because some of that is going to be subjective. So, you know,
yeah, definitely,
it's inevitable. So Jules suggested this episode, and this was also the other day I messaged Jules because I was putting together a lecture on top of some other fantastic work that a fellow lecturer had done about sort of editing for my students. And I was trying to think of other examples of kind of those sort of sentences or things like that which get overused or which don't make sense or are just weird. So she ejaculated, as in, you know, she's saying something loudly. Unless you're writing a Sherlock Holmes novel, you should be avoiding that. And even if you are writing a Sherlock Holmes novel, you should only be using it ironically. But, you know, it's also things like their tongues battled for dominance. What? That I've seen that one so many times. And I'm like, look, unless their tongues are going full medieval melee, I don't want to hear it, okay? Unless that's what's happening, don't want to hear it. And also things like describing eyes as orbs. Just because Byron did it that one time doesn't mean that you should. There's an ongoing joke with...
Oh, I'm not sure it was one time.
Oh. Just because Byron did it. Byron did lots of things. Yeah. Just because Byron does things doesn't mean you should do them. Byron did lots of things that you should not do. And using orbs to describe eyes is one of them. So, yeah, there's an ongoing joke with Amelia, which is onyx orbs to describe eyes. And if you want to make her, if you just want to set her off, then all you have to talk about is like, he gazed at me with his onyx orbs, or he rolled his onyx orbs, and immediately it just gets very funny very quickly. Now, this is not me taking the piss out of people who have used these sentences, because you know what? Most people have used things like that. In fact, most people just pick them up from other people, and that's fine, but it's basically about recognizing that you should maybe not be using some of these, or that you should be using them less. And at the end of the day, it is all a matter of opinion. So if you feel strongly about that, if you really do want their tongues battling for dominance, you go right ahead. But just to say, it's uncomfortable for quite a few people.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing to remember is that you can experience a disproportionate amount of shame as a writer when you look back on something and realise there's a typo, or you've used a really strange speech tag or something like that.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's fine. Your first published book is just the beginning. So unless you have made a decision to stop learning, each book will successively get slightly better in terms of writing technique, usually.
Yeah.
There are exceptions I can think of, but generally for most people, each book gets a little bit better. So, you know, you have to have room to make mistakes and room to learn, and just own the mistakes you do make, or, you know, the slightly less than savory phrases you've come out with.
Yeah. And as we said, you know, readers will have their personal pet peeves too, and you can't do anything about that. If you try to write in a way that will please everyone all the time, you will end up pleasing absolutely nobody any of the time, because you won't be writing for your target audience.
Absolutely. I mean, one example I can think of, and literally I think it's the only person I've ever heard mention this as a pet peeve, is a sort of acquaintance of mine who is a booktuber. And she's a writer as well. She absolutely hates the expression padded. He padded into the kitchen. You know, when you're talking about someone walking in bare feet or you know, stockinged feet kind of thing. It just seems... And I'm like, I do use that one. Should I be changing it? And I'm like, well, no, because sometimes that is the best description for what someone's doing if they're walking quite quietly.
Yeah.
So don't overuse it. But also, that's one person who's got one very specific peeve, and I can't change my entire writing style just for one person.
Yeah. I had someone who got really annoyed at me for using the word barked, as in, like, he barked a laugh, or shut up, he barked. And they got really pissed off, and they made a comment, was like, what, am I reading a book about dogs? And I was like, oh, maybe I overused it. And I looked at it, I was like, I haven't used it that many times, and each time it would be appropriate to call it a bark, but then maybe I needed to use it less. So, as we said, people are going to have their own preferences, and that's fine. You can't please everybody. But being aware of how often you use things can make a big difference in, you know, making it comfortable for even people who are annoyed by certain phrases.
Definitely. My final point before we actually start getting onto these is that you should not make decisions as a writer, or indeed as someone who's marketing a book, based on your own personal opinions on things. You know, you shouldn't make decisions for a wider audience based on that. So just because, for example, you don't buy books based on them having the link to the next book at the end of a book, doesn't mean that hundreds of thousands of other people won't. So, you know, you shouldn't make that decision. I'd say the same thing occurs with writing as well. So you might have a personal peeve that you don't want to use, and that's fine. But if you ever slip, or someone else slips, that might be your personal peeve. So you shouldn't be pushing everything on that particular error, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's actually look at some examples and get into a little bit more detail. So let's start with reader peeves in writing.
So basically these were curated by me doing a very quick search and then searching my own brain as well for things that I'd seen that people had said they didn't like. I've tried to go with the ones that are most common and not too specialist, because I think it can get a bit nuts if you're kind of like, oh, this person doesn't like this. This person is very specifically a musical person and doesn't like this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll have things where if people... It's like the hospital thing for me, whereby if anybody tries to restart someone's heart with a defibrillator, I get really, really angry about it, because you have to do chest compressions first. But not everybody has that knowledge. So, you know, that's a personal peeve for me.
No, break his ribs first, says Jules. Break his ribs before you electrocute him.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, if that's how you've seen a resuscitation scene, I'm quite worried, Madeline.
Sorry, I don't mean the ribs. I mean the what's is it the sternum? The sternum that can break.
Well, it is the ribs that can break, but it's quite rare actually to break ribs during chest compressions. And when people say break ribs, it's a crack. Anyway, this is a tangent, and we said we weren't going to do that.
Sorry, my apologies. Please continue.
This is basically things that time and time again, various different readers have said this pulls me out of the story, and it's different permutations of the same thing. So without much more ado, I will go into the first one. And my first one is, not every emotion provokes a gastrointestinal response. I want to say I am very guilty in my first drafts of doing this. If a character feels something, there's a 90% chance they're going to feel it with their stomach first.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you're afraid or you're nervous or you're excited, then yes, you probably will get either a swooping sensation or a sensation of nausea or nerves or whatever, but that's not the only place. And if, you know, you're having a character having an emotional reaction, and honestly, an emotional reaction with your characters shouldn't be every other paragraph. It should be comparatively rare compared to the rest of the text. So if all they're doing is feeling something in their stomach, then what you're saying to your reader is they have some kind of stomach issue.
Yeah,
we're not really sure what it is.
They should see a doctor.
So remember things like you can be angry and the palms of your hands can ache, or you can be so angry that your head hurts, or that, you know, you genuinely feel like you can't see straight because you've stopped taking on as much oxygen as you were before and you've gone slightly dizzy. So there's lots and lots of different ways that you can feel it. You can physically feel an emotion in your body. And it's about paying attention and doing a little bit of research.
Yeah. And something else to remember as well is that actually different people will also experience different things when they have strong emotional responses. So you are going to want to think about that in terms of your characters as well. So, you know, someone might very well, depending on what their blood pressure is like and stuff like that, strong emotions might actually make them very physically feel the blood rushing from their face, or you know, make them feel a bit dizzy, or, you know, they might suddenly start actually feel like palpitations in their throat or stuff like that, or their throat getting very sort of constricted or things along those lines. Like, I know people who, like, I've seen people who, when they get angry, you can see their heartbeat, like, thrumming in their faces. They get sort of bright red, and you can see the veins, and you can see the heartbeat in the throat. That happens to some people, but it doesn't happen to everybody. So that's worth considering as well.
Definitely.
So the next one is... too many typos and bad editing, or a lack of understanding of spelling and grammar. So, readers' mileage is going to vary here. Some readers are far more tuned into errors and spelling and grammar and syntax. And obviously it can depend on the genre. So, erotica, no one probably is reading that for the style and accuracy. I think they're mostly reading it for the sexy scenes. But that being said...
yeah, usually they're busy. I heard one erotica writer who's sort of an acquaintance. I don't know her very well, but she makes around £5,000 a month writing erotica. So fair play. She's obviously at the top of her game, or, you know, pretty close to it. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, she doesn't bother getting an editor. She used to, but it's really just money that she was throwing down the drain because her readers don't care about it. When they're reading her stories, they're kind of getting busy with how she put it. So she's like, you know, I try not to make too many errors, but things creep in and ultimately it doesn't matter because the reader is so busy doing something else. They're not worried about spag.
Yeah.
They don't care about the punctuation.
Yeah, I was going to say, by the way, spag, by the way, is spelling, punctuation and grammar. just in case no one realized that. Obviously there's always going to be at least one typo that will creep into even like majorly published books, you know, part of, you know, the big five traditional publishing houses. There's always at least one typo which slips in, and that is okay. It's human error. That being said, if your book is riddled with errors, especially if it's indie published, you will lose readers in droves and probably get reported to Amazon for selling a shoddy product. Now, I'm going to speak here from, you know, the position of someone who is neurodivergent and someone who does have dyslexia. This is hard. It is really difficult. You can, you know, be a good writer. You can be a strong writer and still make a lot of mistakes with this. It just means that you have to be conscious of it and spend a little bit of time with it. And again, I'm well aware that the first draft of the Sons of Thestian did have quite a few mistakes in it, and that there are mistakes dotted throughout the others of my book. It is inevitable, but taking the extra time to really look through it does make a big difference. And, you know, getting an editor where appropriate, again, will make a big difference.
Definitely. Another thing you can do, obviously, you shouldn't write something and then press publish unless you're writing erotica. And again, that's up to you. But for everything else, you shouldn't, because, you know, even if you're really, really good with SPAG and, you know, getting the right word in the right place, and I'm a very wordy person, and yet I have still used the wrong version of complacent in various books, which is quite ironic, really, when you think about it. And various other things. You need other eyes on your work. You can't just throw it out there. You're disrespecting your reader if you do that. So Madeline's right. Something you can do, however, if you want to, you know, if you don't want to be going back to an editor 3 or 4 times, which some writers have to do, then you can use things like the text-to-word function or text-to-speech function on Word or a similar program. And it basically, you know, it's very flat, but it will read your book to you, and you'll find that you actually catch more errors that way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, even better if you have, you're in a position where you can workshop or actually read your work out to someone, or they can read it out to you. So those who are part of sort of groups or things like that, it does make a big difference, even if it does feel embarrassing. So give it a go.
Okay, weird speech tags.
Yay! So,
from which we get our title. 99% of the time, if you are saying a character said something, you should use the word said, because basically it reads like punctuation. Yeah. When someone's reading reading a sentence, they don't read the sentence and then go read the comma. They just see it as a pause. So, and it's the same with said. So when you have a character saying, "Oh, he had glorious blue eyes," she said, then the reader will say, "Oh, well, that character is speaking about that character."
Yeah.
They won't be distracted by the fact that she's just said it out loud.
Yeah, exactly.
If you use the word expostulated or ejaculated, or, you know, that there's various others, don't think you're being boring. You're actually just giving a nice little, basically invisible word for the reader.
Yeah, which you should be doing, unless you very particularly need to show them saying it in a certain way. And that's the difference. When attention should be drawn to the way that they're saying it, because that actually provides something, you can use another word, such as whisper, murmur, mutter, cried, shouted, etc. If it's important for that, you know, to be worthy of attention. If you're just using those words in order to fill the space, don't do it. Just use said. I should also say that, of course, this goes in terms of the narrative, and most of this is actually to do with the narrative. When it comes to dialogue, you might have someone actually literally saying, "And then she ejaculated loudly, by God," you know, something like that. In which case, that's your character's choice of words, which will say a lot about them.
Yes.
So that's a different matter entirely.
Definitely. I will say that I give leeway to words like growled, snarled, hissed, laughed, chuckled, etc. You can't really chuckle a sentence, but the reader knows what you mean when you say it, because you're suggesting that the person was, the words were chopped up with laughter, kind of thing. Some readers actually hate the word chuckled for some reason, and I don't see what the problem is.
I think it's a cute word.
Yeah, you can get away with some of those words, use sparingly, if you're writing in first person, because that is your main character, you're in that main character's point of view, and their opinion is that the other person said it in that way, that the other opinion jeered or sneered at them. So that's, you know, you should be very sparing in how you use those words, but I still think there's a place for them. You've just got to be careful. You've got to use them in a way that almost makes them invisible.
Yeah.
But we all know what a metaphor is, right? And that is basically what we're talking here.
I'm super guilty of this and I will not stop. Anyway, so this is one that really gets me unless it's done very well. And that's phonetically spelled dialect. And yes, I'm looking at you very specifically, Wuthering Heights.
Although that actually wasn't that bad. It had one or two lines of phonetically spelled dialect, and then the rest of it was just word placement.
Yeah. But just... The thing is, like, it really does depend, because sometimes it works very effectively, and it also... It's worth thinking about the format in which the book is going to be read. If something's read out loud, writing out sort of a dialect phonetically is more likely to work. And, you know, there are authors who have written entire books like this, and they have succeeded. But you do have to be incredibly skilled not to make your reader want to skip great big chunks. Because if you look at that and you just see apostrophes and strange things and words that you can't quite read, I mean, just from a dyslexic's point of view, all I see is patterns that I don't recognise, and it brings me out in a cold sweat. It really does. Which is why, for the most part, you can actually get away with only just, you know, putting in a few chosen words and sort of rearranging words in dialogue in order to kind of get something across. For instance, let's jump to Paul Dark. Let's jump to Paul Dark and say, you know, instead of it is, tis, or nay, instead of no, you know, like, nay, Ross, tis for the best. Okay, immediately I get the idea. Right, they're speaking ye old Cornish. All right, okay, so we've dropped the H every now and again. Well, off you get on your horse. Okay, fine. I can just about understand that. But the moment you really start trying to... And I apologise for my bad accents there, but you get what I mean. The moment you basically try to actually write it completely phonetically, you are going to cause difficulties for your reader, depending particularly on... You don't know what difficulty levels your reader has with reading, so it's something you should be aware of. That being said, you can have a point of view character, if that's not the person with the accent, who then meets someone who has a thick accent that they themselves can't understand. So for instance, you could have a character who then is talking to someone else whose words are, you know, you've very heavily written it as phonetic, and your character themselves can't quite or is struggling to understand what is being said. That's something I've done with Aaron in Blood of the Delphi, though he mostly just talks in nonsensical sentences with a tiny bit of phonetic spelling in there. But that is absolutely perfectly allowed as well. Because in that case, the aim is to make the reader feel that they've read dialect without ever actually reading it, essentially.
And that is the real skill, is making the reader think that that's what they've read. I recently sort of took a little foray into Geordie, and I found that the odd well-placed colloquialism actually helps. So instead of saying something's good, you say it's proper belter.
Yeah.
And, you know, anyone who's familiar with that sort of part of the world is kind of like, oh, that's what they're saying. Or you know, with Kelsey, for example, Kelsey doesn't have her accent spelled out phonetically, but the fact that she'll say he was a braw thing, or here it's a bonny wee thing. You know, she's speaking this sort of mid-level Scots accent all the time.
Yeah, and she uses the word ken as well.
Yeah.
I get excited every time I read Kelsey's work and I'm like, ooh! For some reason, I just really enjoy it. And, I can hear her.
Yeah, and a lot of it is about how words are arranged as well. I mean, if you're writing an Irish accent, and you've got to be careful, because guess what? There isn't just one accent for all of Ireland. There's many, many.
You have accents per household, really, in Ireland. So
you do. For example, my family's sort of from Cork-type area, or partly from Cork-type area, partly from Tipperary. But in the Corked Type area, everybody speaks about an octave higher than everybody else in Ireland for some reason, or it seems like they are. So there's a lot of rising inflection. But one thing that you find that most Irish people do is they'll say something, reframe it as a question, and then repeat it back. And the reason for this is that there's no yes or no in Irish. So if you're saying, oh, did you see him? Then you would say, I saw him. Or I did not see him. You would not say yes or no because there's no yes or no.
Ah.
So that is why you notice Irish people will seem to be repeating themselves. It's because they're asking the question and then answering the question.
Okay, that's pretty cool. I did not know that. Thank you for that little tidbit.
So it's basically about paying attention. I think this has particularly offended people recently because there's been a lot more sort of YA fantasy in sort of the India type area. Mm-hmm. And you know, at least sort of 10 years ago, people were kind of like spelling out the Indian accent phonetically.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was an ill-considered attempt at being at not being exclusive, not excluding people from that part of the world.
Yeah.
But it came across as mockery. Yeah. And offended quite a lot of people, so you've got to be very careful. Okay, so next one. Out of place emotional reactions. So someone says something mildly amusing and the other person laughs hysterically. Now, if they're, I don't know, really high or really drunk or, you know, having some sort of emotional breakdown about something else, then that might be appropriate. But if it's literally just the sort of like, aha, why did the chicken cross the road joke, and it deserves a smirk at best, then maybe don't have them rolling on the floor laughing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, again, it can be that the one that I've seen people... I've said something like this, but I've never said sort of from a third person point of view. Someone's voice climbing several octaves. Well, if you think about this literally, this is very funny because unless they're Mariah Carey, then they're in the whistle range of the soprano end. which means they're so high-pitched, their words are probably not making much sense anymore. And most people actually can't get to the whistle end of the soprano scale.
No, it's actually very high.
So, again, if it's a first person saying her voice climbs several octaves, well, what you're saying is they suddenly became very piercingly shrill.
Yeah.
Which is fine, because that's metaphorical and that's one person's point of view. If you're a third person omniscient, her voice climbs several octaves, then the reader's going to think you mean it literally.
Yeah. And again, yeah, it will depend, because also on the kind of the narrative, because you can have an omniscient, you know, a third person narrator, but with it still being close perspective, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's basically about actually thinking, how does this come across? Do you mean literal or metaphorical? But yeah, this is one of those things. You've probably heard of My Immortal.
Oh, Jules. God, yeah. I've even read a tiny bit of it by accident. And I don't know, I think my eyes sort of boiled in my head. But
there's an exchange in it which is really famous, and I can't even remember the exact of it, but basically it was, instead of using the word said, it was a whole bunch of other words instead. So it was the weird speech tags, but through them, the emotions changed so drastically. it's laughable. You know, so you can definitely show emotion, but as said, it should be proportionate. And, you know, you can then actually make it disproportionate, but it has to be for a reason. One thing I always think of that I really do enjoy is in the third recent Star Trek movie with Chris Pine and Carl Urban, etc., and Zachary Quinto. There's this great bit where Bones and Spock have been separated from the group, and Spock is actually quite hurt. And it's just Bones and Spock, and the pair of them are speaking, and Bones makes a very small joke, and Spock starts to laugh, and Bones laughs as well, and then looks over, and Spock is still laughing, and his face falls, and he goes, "By God, you're delirious!" Because even though Spock isn't laughing hard, he's just kind of doing that sort of laughing. Bones is like, "No, you shouldn't be laughing. That's weird for you."
You're a Vulcan. Yeah, laughter's a good one because, I mean, you might have characters who have whip-smart dialogue and, you know, every few lines you get another funny witticism. And I, I wouldn't say it's every other line for me, but I definitely like to put those sort of lines in because I find them funny.
Yeah.
If I then doubled down and had a character laughing hard at every single one of them, then what I'm basically doing is putting my hands in the air and giving myself a big round of applause for being so witty. And it does not come across well. So you actually don't have to have your characters react to every single witticism. I mean, there was the one part that I will stand by this because I think it is funny enough that someone would have laughed that hard. Because it's just a bunch of people mucking around. But in the most recent book that Madeline's just read...
I was just thinking of this scene.
There is a moment where Amy does not want to clean a room. And Rebecca does something and Amy sort of takes it and runs with it. And of course, Steve is standing nearby watching the whole thing. And it, from his perspective, it really is very funny.
It is. I was crying with laughter when I was... Particularly if you imagine it. Because if you're just reading it on the page and you're reading it cold, then, you know, that doesn't work. But if you picture the entire scene, the running around, the sort of the Rebecca desperately chasing after Amy as she sort of whoops and jumps and sort of like... sort of dodges out of the way, putting on a high-pitched voice, it just becomes increasingly funny. So I was literally thinking of this scene just as you started talking. I think that was appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, you can have lots of funny lines in your books, you just don't need to signal that they're funny. Basically, if they're funny, the reader will laugh anyway. They don't need the characters to point them out for you.
Yeah. Okay, so the next one, and this is a funny one, it's actually too much thinking during dialogue. So it's a bit tricky, but sometimes dialogue is uncomfortable or stilted, and this means that the main character is, you know, thinking. Perhaps they're thinking about their words, perhaps they're thinking about what's happening, etc. But you should resist the urge to over-explain things. You know, let the beats, the dialogue, and a few physical tells explain for you. Don't drop a huge chunk of exposition in there. If you legitimately have to explain something, have the non-point of view character doing something else at the same time, so there's a reason for them not to assume the MC is basically a faulty mechanoid that's got stuck mid-speech.
Yeah, see, this is kind of... It's something I'm guilty of, but at the same time, it's something that makes me go, oh, that's really clumsy when I read it in a book. So this is the sort of thing that gets edited out of my first drafts before even Madeline gets to see them.
I also think what happens is that if you do that as well, and then you've got a whole kind of little ramble, you kind of lose the pacing of the conversation.
You really do. I mean, it can be a case of, as we've said, yeah, the character's thinking. But, you know, really there's only time if you want to keep the flow for them to notice one or two things. If there's a natural break in the conversation while one character's trying to work out what to say. I've seen Shauna Maguire do it very well in the October Day series, and it's usually when she's working in a recap without being info-dumpy.
Yeah.
And bearing in mind she's now on the 15th book of the October Day series, so a bit like Harry Dresden, there is a lot of recapping to do.
Yeah.
Just something I'm starting to really appreciate myself now. And it's a case of she'll have October and her sister May, and May will be making cookies because May makes cookies a lot. It's great. So, you know, October sort of considers something May said while May is sticking the cookies in the oven. So you can do things like that. Mm. And it doesn't break the flow because you've still got the character in action.
Yeah. And what, I mean, you can also do is you can actually show the character might have actually gone off on a tangent in their own head by someone saying, hello, you still with us?
Yeah.
And sort of bringing it back in. But then that should be very, you know, that should be a conscious decision on your part.
Definitely. Okay. The next one. I think this is kind of most people's bugbear. But basically, characters giving flattering descriptions of themselves. So let's say you're... in third person omniscient, you can get away with a certain amount of she was tall and willowy and had long dark wavy hair, what have you, as long as it's not too in your face. But if you're in first person and you then have your character stand in front of a mirror and appraise themselves, what it says is, yeah, the author wants you to know what the character looks like. But on the other hand, it's also really weird because, okay, hands up everybody, obviously I can't see, but hands up everybody who, when they look in the mirror, appraises themselves physically and doesn't just go, oh my god, my eyes look like piss holes in the snow today. I did not get enough sleep last night.
Wrong, Jules. I stand in the mirror and catalogue everything.
Do you stand there and think, like, you know, as a male writer would, wow, I've got magnificent breasts. They're so perky and well separated today.
Yeah. I wish my breasts were a little bit more even, or, you know... I'm feeling a bit depressed, so my breasts have withdrawn into themselves.
Yeah, that's the latest thing. Mood breaths apparently will predict the weather for you. It's just really bizarre. Yeah, you need far less physical description than you think you do. You probably need a little bit, because most people want a rough idea of whether a character's tall or short or medium height, and maybe what hair colour and eye colour they've got, although you know, you don't have to do that. You don't need a 3-page description that gives you basically everything from their shoe size to their eyebrow shade.
No. And there are ways, you know, of actually incorporating that into other things. So you want to give, you know, a sense of character. You want to give it to describe the hair. You could talk about the character looking in the mirror, you know, as they're doing their hair up. You know, so then you can give it like, I pulled my messy curls into a bun at the top of my head, or, you know, my curls were all over the place so I swept them back, you know, something along those lines, or my hair needed a cut, or, you know, or I needed to recolour my hair. You know, there are ways of doing that which also kind of show the mood, the tone, the sort of the feeling, without it basically being, I had long sweeping brown hair which gently brushed over my shoulders in a avant-garde, you know, something like that. You don't necessarily need that. Unless, of course, you have a character who is a little bit vain, in which case it kind of makes sense for them to look at themselves in the mirror and just be like, damn, I look good today, you know.
Yeah, but I mean that will come into something, obviously, that we'll say in a minute, but yeah. Basically they shouldn't be standing there going, oh, look how beautiful I am, but no, I'm so undesirable, kind of thing, which is, I think, where a lot of this trope, this issue has come from.
Yeah.
The other thing you can do, you know, drip feed some physical attributes in, so you can use a little bit of internal comparison for your main character. You've got a character with curly hair, and she's meeting her friend who has gorgeous straight black hair or something, which is always shiny and never tangles, or so it seems to her. Or you've got a big and rather ugly scarred man, and every time he meets someone who's clearly the flower of perfect knighthood, he's kind of glowering at them. So you're kind of telling by default.
Looking at you, Gregory.
Yes, basically. Yeah. Mention it when it becomes relevant. Obviously, things like, I mean, I've seen readers get equally annoyed when they find out a character is short or tall when they've been picturing them another way. I've seen that jar people as well. So it's about balance.
Yeah. So the next one is the secret MacGyver. This is one which is basically, this screams Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah.
This is like, if you have a character who has a leaning toward a skill or has a superpower that will help save the day, you cannot bring it in at the 11th hour. There is nothing more frustrating when it's just, well, did you know I could do, I can do this. What? Oh, isn't that convenient? No, that's really irritating. It's the smoking gun thing. You know, if you're going to have the gun appear in Act 5, it needs to have been introduced in Act 2, kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, this is one that's a particularly an issue for fantasy and science fiction, or so it seems. And I think we can thank Anne McCaffrey for it a little bit. Basically, unreadable, unpronounceable names. So you should absolutely use ethnically appropriate names and spellings where needed. It bugs the hell out of me when people set things in Ireland and don't use Irish names that are appropriate to the historical period. Or they don't spell them, or they say, well, it's too hard for other people, so I'm just going to give you an English name. That's just lazy and kind of offensive. But if you're writing science fiction or fantasy and you think, I just want them to have an exotic sounding name, so you spell it with 6 X's and a Z and 2 apostrophes, then you've got real issues.
Yeah, it's. Look, I'm guilty of it in some respects.
I've never seen you write anything like that.
Okay, all right, not that many X's and Z's, but also, again, I'm dyslexic. I've got to be kind to myself. But yeah, it just. Like, not to pick on Sarah J. Maas, because I haven't read the Throne of Glass series, so I don't know, but I'm part of a group on Facebook with a lot of people who have. And one of the most frequent posts I see is, how do we pronounce these names? And the thing with Sarah J. Maas is that actually most of those names are not that difficult to understand how to pronounce.
Yeah.
They're actually quite easy comparatively, which gives you an idea of how and why you need to be careful. Because seriously, people will get confused regardless, even if it's a regular name. Got a friend called Hamish who people don't know how to pronounce his name. They think it's Hamish or something along those lines. And then people are like, how do you pronounce Island? Is it Aylin? Etc. Hell, even I get stuck up on one of Sarah J. Maas's ones, which is she has a character called Kale. Kale, spelt CH. AOL, and it's meant to be chaos, but then with an L instead of an S. But I have always, whenever I see that name, have just read it as Cole.
See, because it's
Always.
CH, I've always gone ch.
Chol, chol.
I would have automatically read it as a hard C because I'm Irish.
Yeah.
So if it's a name and it's a C, then it's a hard C in my book. But
Yeah.
yeah, the CH is kind of like, yeah, okay, I didn't know. I've been saying chael
See, there you go.
So, I mean, in some ways, it doesn't matter how readers pronounce things in their own heads. Because they're not going to read the audiobook, it doesn't matter. But if it's a name where every time the reader reads it, they stumble over it and it knocks them out of the story, then that's an issue because they're going to stop reading.
Yeah, absolutely. So you do need to be very considerate of that. And yeah, as we said, even sort of names which don't include lots of X's and Z's. I mean, no one really knows how to pronounce an X anyway. Let's not lie. No one really knows how to do it, except unless it's pronounced X, like X-ray or something like that. Everyone gets confused. So don't do it. Don't do it to people.
It's actually a ZTH sound in case anyone's interested. But yes, moving on to the next one.
Xylophone.
Okay, anachronisms and unlikable slang words. So basically, if something is really out of place, I once read a Jane Eyre retelling. I should not do this to myself, by the way, because I read Jane Eyre retellings and I'm inevitably always and invariably always really, really incandescent with fury when I read them. I just shouldn't do it. I just get so angry. I'm pretty sure Madeline got treated to like a 2-hour rant via text message as I read one.
Yes, I did.
But this one was kind of like, it tempted me because it was kind of looking at Mr. Rochester's early life and his relationship with his family. They described him as cranky. It was clearly an American writer. Cranky is not a British word, so for a start, there's that as an issue, and I'm going to stand by that one. That is a hill I will die on. The other thing is, that's not a 19th century appropriate word,
Yeah.
cranky. And as a word to describe a grown man, that's mad. So yeah, that was it. That book got put down. So,
Yeah.
and I appreciate that's a very personal example, but it was an anachronistic term. And it's the same like if you had a Tudor story and you were saying that Anne Boleyn was like hella mad at Henry VIII or something. It's sort of like, unless you were deliberately writing an ironic alternate history version with modern language, which, obviously you would set out your stall fairly early on,
Yeah.
that's not right.
Yeah. It makes me think of the Gospel of Loki, which I've spoken about in the past. The Gospel of Loki is full of modern terms, which are used because there's this meant to be the sense that Loki is retelling, well, he's retelling this story, but he's retelling it in the modern day, so he's telling us as modern readers. But even then, I found it quite jarring in places. to have him using this quite modern language. And that was still, it was still appropriate. So it's something that you do need to think of very carefully. And again, this is also going to be a difficulty when it comes to particularly American writers writing, meant to be writing sort of English characters or things like that in sort of, or European past. Like, again, I don't mean to be picking on Sarah J. Maas, but it's just because I've read it recently. Describing trousers as pants. He pulled on his pants, and I'm like, or describing the autumn as fall, despite the fact she has an autumn court, makes me kind of go, but what? They wouldn't use those words. Those are modern words. Those are modern words.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and it's also the same with using the word okay or cool or things like that. But okay is a funny one because we tend to think of okay as being something which is quite sort of old, but it's not. It's actually, again, quite a modern turn of phrase. And certainly if you're writing something set in the Renaissance or the medieval period, you should not have characters saying okay. Unless, and here's the crux of it, sometimes you can get away with it if you actually have characters speaking mostly in a modern language when they wouldn't even be speaking in English, so you're sort of like meant to be translating it. But then what's happened is that you've created another sort of suspension of disbelief. So Da Vinci's Demons, for instance, the Starz TV show, it was a lot of rubbish, but a lot of fun at the same time. And, you know, good work to the actors. They did a fantastic job with it. But they were using modern words quite a lot of the time, like, okay, all right, fine, which they absolutely should not have been using. But then at the same time, realistically, they shouldn't have been speaking in English, full stop. So because of the general tone and the kind of the modern way that they were approaching it, again, like with the Gospel of Loki, it felt appropriate, but it's about the tone that you are trying to write in. So if you are trying to write a Regency novel, you should not be using the word cranky or things like that.
Yeah. Also, as a little aside, apparently most readers hate the word panties. I'm going to say, just go with the word underwear. Underwear is fine. We're Brits. Apparently we would use the word knickers. I think the word knickers is ridiculous. It makes me kind of think of convent school and the stupid gym knickers we had. So I'm like, just go with underwear, guys. There's always a better word.
Right, that's it. I'm going to try and get the word knickers into every one of every book I write now. Just for you, Jules.
Thank you so much.
Okay. The Buttery Quotient. I can't read that word. Why do you do this to me? This is when an author has imprinted on a word or a phrase and will not let it go. So it just gets repeated over and over and over again through their work. There's easily accessible online thesauruses, and if you stretch yourself, you can always find a new way to describe something. So there's no excuse for this one. Well, yeah, there isn't any excuse for it. The problem is that you need to be conscious of it. We all have phrases that actually we overuse. I'm guilty of it, Jules is guilty of it, everybody is guilty of it. The fact of the matter is that you need to be aware of the words or the phrases that you do overuse so that when you finish writing something, you can just go to the Find tab on Word or whatever you're using and search through it to see how many times you've written it and then edit it out. I cannot tell you the amount of times that I have done this, and I'm aware that there's probably still a few things that have prevailed, but you do need to be very, very aware of this. Again, I don't mean to pick on Sarah J. Maas. It's just in the forefront of my mind because, again, I've read it recently and I am part of this group, so I do see posts. But one thing a lot of people get annoyed at is how much the characters purr. There's a lot of purring involved.
And scenting and purring. I think the thing is, if it's a word or phrase that's used in a descriptive way, when you repeat use it, then absolutely it becomes very, very obvious. And she's not the only one, but she's one of the worst people for buttery sunlight.
I loved that description the first time I read it. I loved the idea of buttery sunlight. It made me feel all fluffy and warm, and I really liked it. But yeah, it then sort of got overused and it lost the fact, it felt very special the first time I saw it and it made me feel all yeah. good. And then
I think the thing is, it's not even her original description. It's something that she's picked up from reading other people who have also overused it, who have picked it up from people who've also overused it. And I think it's kind of like using the word butchered, for example, for when someone is slaughtered, or you know, when there's a whole scale massacre, they were butchered. And when you've read that 50 times within a single book, or within a single half of a book, then yes, it's very annoying.
It also makes me think of, I've been watching this series, which I'll be talking a little bit about later, which is a docudrama about samurai. And every episode, there's meant to be another, like, this wasn't just a battle, this was a massacre. And I'm like, they're doing a lot of massacres. And then it's just, they're like, what would be one of the most important battles? And I'm like, another one! Apparently these are all very important battles. Which they were, to be fair. But yeah, we laughed every episode we've watched it, because we're like, whoo-wee, they're getting through a lot of these. Short period of time, but they're really racking them out.
Definitely.
It would be the bloodiest battle. What about the last one? It was bloodier than the last one.
So moving on to the next one. Going around the houses with a description or using a grammatically insane phrase. So this is actually something that came up when Madeline and I were kind of talking to Amelia the other day. She'd been re-listening to The Hunger Games. And just to prove that even a multi-million selling best-selling author can, you know, make a few cock-ups on her first book. There was a description of Katniss where she's saying, my throat got all tight, my eyes started stinging in that way they did right before I cried. I'm like, okay, pick one or the other. Either describe the physical occurrence or tell us you're about to cry. Don't mash them together and do both, because that's so clumsy. And then I came back with something that I'd read in Suzanne Young's program books, which was the main, I mean, to be honest, 90% of those books are the characters bursting into tears because they're so depressed. And they're not depressed because there's anything really wrong with them. They're depressed because society keeps telling them that they're going to be suicidal. I mean, these are nuts books. I do not recommend them at all. But the main character keeps saying, I felt the start of a cry. Meaning, I felt the start of, I was about to start crying. But it was so jarring. It set my teeth on edge so badly.
Yeah.
Every time I read it.
Well, because the thing is, you can say, oh, I need a good cry. But that's used in a very particular sort of context. And it doesn't work there.
No, definitely.
Okay, so, as you know, isms. this is going to be a hard one, but you should definitely try to avoid using dialogue to provide essential backstory. Don't info dump in dialogue. If a character is supposed to know, why is another character explaining? Now, I'm guilty of this, and the thing is, you can do this well. You can convey information through dialogue. In fact, dialogue can be a good way to convey information in a helpful, easy kind of manner to understand without it being too much show and not enough tell.
Yeah.
However, it is one of those things, it's like, well, as you know, we're here because, okay, if they know, then why are you repeating it? What? Why are you? They know! They know!
This is especially the case when it's an obscure family tradition or something, and you say, well, as you know, Mother, every year we take the Great Potato Sack to Potato Mountain in order to worship the Great Potato King. You're like, well, if we do it every year and it's like, it's great family tradition, why are you having to tell her about it anyway? So if you're ever tempted to go, as you know, in dialogue, then check yourself, because the chances are that you probably don't need that sentence at all. And if you do, then really you should be just telling. There should be a little bit of tell before you get to the dialogue.
Yeah. And I mean, to be honest, there are ways that you can, again, show this, which is, you know, like, have you got the potatoes? Don't worry, I've got the potatoes. It's not like I haven't done this every single year since I was born.
Yeah.
You know, you can sort of do that. It's like, well, don't be late. The Potato King will be enraged and send a flood. Yeah, I know the story. Let's go, kind of thing. You know, there's ways that you can convey that information without it basically being, well, as you know, Mother, we're here because...
Yeah, small aside to show some appreciation for Madeline just running with my insane scenario there, and just like it was a normal thing to talk about.
Absolutely. I'm very invested in the Potato King and his potato sacrifices. Anyway.
Okay, this is another one that most people will go, oh, yeah. This is the insecure, awkward character who is somehow irresistible to the opposite sex.
Oh my god! Okay, look, your main character does not need to be absolutely irresistible to the opposite sex. It's okay to have a main character who is not sexy. It's also okay to have a main character who is sexy, but who still isn't totally irresistible to literally everybody they meet.
Yeah, it just reminds me of that that line from 10 Things I Hate About You. It's like, well, what is it with this chick? Does she have beer-flavoured nipples kind of thing? yeah, even if somebody is absolutely gorgeous and, you know, has everything going on, and, you know, they're the sort of person who turns everybody's head because people are kind of like, did I just see that? And there are those people out there, sadly, you know. Mm. I'm really sorry, but sometimes those people exist. They are a minority, though. We should be very kind to them because they're as strange as people on the other end of the spectrum. but basically, yeah, they shouldn't be absolutely irresistible to anybody because there is so much that goes into attraction anyway.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, and then having someone... I think the trouble is this has come from the female perspective. This has come from... the idea that you are not allowed to be aware of your own desirability.
Yeah, it's also...
which is, you know, a problem in its own right.
Yeah. Look, there's something to be said in the fact that their confidence is attractive.
Yeah.
And if you project the sense of, I am confident and I am comfortable, you are more likely to appear attractive to other people because you're kind of taking up space and you're basically, you're taking up your own room and you're not being apologetic for it. If you have a kind of state of mind which says that I don't want to be seen, you're less likely to kind of be seen. You know, you're more likely to kind of dress in things which are not going to make you stand out. You're more likely to hunch. You're more likely to, you know, not try and take up lots of room. So there is something to be said about not being noticed, even if you are attractive. But the fact of the matter is that there is, as Jules has said, too much emphasis placed on the idea of being confident in the way you look is a bad thing. Unless you have been largely underconfident or, you know, vulnerable or etc. for a long period of time, you know, but now you've been made to sort of realise that you are attractive, but you're still not entirely sure about it. The fact of the matter is that for most people, they might just feel kind of normal. They're not thinking about how attractive they are most of the time. And then they might suddenly go, right, well, I'm off to dinner tonight, so I want to make myself look pretty. And what they consider to be looking good is going to be different from person to person. You know, you could have someone who really feels like pretty to me is to be wearing black lipstick, heavy eyeliner, have, you know, very, very, like, pale skin, fake eyelashes, you know, wear... I was going to say webbing. Webbing is not the right word. Fishnet tights.
Yes, you know, they, my webbed feet on them.
My webbed feet, yeah. You know, they could be there like, this is me. This is, I look great like this. And fantastic, yes. But not everyone is going to turn around and be like, hell yeah, that's insanely attractive. There are going to be some people who are like, that's entirely my type. And there are going to be some people who are like, that, I'm afraid of that. Like on the other side of that, you might see someone who goes, you know, I'm going to wear a long sort of flowy skirt, have my hair down, not wear any makeup. And for some people, that's like, well, I'm not really interested. And for other people, that's like, oh, wow, what an ethereal beauty, etc. Yeah. People are attracted to different things. End of discussion. And if you make an effort for your appearance, everybody can look better or can feel attractive if they've made an effort with their appearance. So it's not this static thing, really.
No, just a final point to add to this one. There is a male equivalent, and that is the male character who is an average Joe, but for some reason every woman throws herself at him, so there's clearly a bit of male fantasy bullshit going on there.
Yeah, particularly when he's an average Joe who doesn't actually act particularly nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the whole sort of insecure about my looks and attractiveness,
yeah.
I'm flypaper. My attractiveness tends to be a sort of female thing, as though that in itself is a desirable quality, and it's not. It's perfectly okay to think it doesn't matter if I'm beautiful or not. I like who I am. That's actually quite attractive. Okay.
Yes.
So, next point.
Okay, so this is characters who cannot possibly seem to refuse the offer of sex. Right. Okay, so if your character, if you feature a main character who genuinely has A, problem saying no or uses sex as a crutch, or B, is a succubus who lives on sexual encounters, or C, this is a serious part of their character arc, that's absolutely fine. It's fine if you have a character who enjoys having sex and who frequently has sex because that's kind of who they are. I'm looking at you, Rufus Merle. Anyway, Bex in
Harker and Rufus Black together would be interesting.
Oh, they would have a great night together. Anyway, but if all of your characters are continually hopping into bed with literally everyone, what are you actually trying to say? If you just want to write smut, there is a market for that, but don't just call it science fiction or fantasy. You can show someone is liberated and innovate
uninhibited?
Thank you. Uninhibited about sex. Sex positive, in fact, without them even taking their clothes off. That is absolutely possible. You don't literally need to have all of your characters all at once always having sex. Also, sex means different things to different people, and it's sort of, unless you literally have a group, your characters are all succubuses, or you have a group of, I don't know, sex fiends or something like that, you know, they're not all immediately going to be like, hi, I met you, you're pretty, let's get into bed straight away. Some of them might be like, actually, I kind of like to know people first. And some of them might be like, actually, I don't want to know you, I just want to have sex. But it's going to be different for different people, and that should be reflected in your work.
Yeah, it's difficult to put a finger on, but it's always weird when it seems that someone can't say no.
But yeah.
You know, when you have a character who's kind of like, I'm tempted because I'm physically attracted to you, but I know it wouldn't be enough for me, so I'm gonna pass on it tonight, and everybody goes away and it's cool, kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's also possible for a character to feel sexually attracted to someone and for them not to have sex. I'm gonna provide some examples, again drawing from the Hamartia cycle, which is that in book two, Rufus, after certain experiences, doesn't particularly want to have sex with anybody. But he finds out that he's kind of a little bit interested in Boyd. He thinks Boyd is interesting. And so initially he's like, okay, well, do you think Boyd would sort of be up for that? And then he finds out Boyd is very asexual. And he's like, oh, well, but maybe we could still date. And Faye's like, no, you couldn't. You would drive him crazy and he would definitely dissect you. So that ends there. It never goes any further than that. And it's, you know, it's not left with this whole pining of, ah, but we could have been. It was just a momentary thing and that's all. But then you have Zachary. Zachary, who at one point someone says, hey, your son is here. And Zachary goes, I have a son. And then stops and has to think about the last time he had sex in order to figure out whether it's possible for him to have a son. He's like, when was the last time I had sex? I think it was like 2 decades ago. Like, it's possible. People just have different things. And so it's possible also that, you know, you have a character who's like, actually, we kind of want to have sex. Both of us want to have sex. But it's not going to happen for various reasons. And that also doesn't need to be a huge, we haven't had sex, but we keep continuously thinking about having sex with one another, unless you're kind of building that up to something. So, yeah.
I would also like to point out that this is something that genuinely happens in real life.
Yeah.
There was a friend I went to college with, and he and I sort of had a bit of a drunken snog, as you do when you're a teenager, or in your early 20s, and you know, we stayed good friends and everything. And afterwards, we jokingly referred to ourselves as the shag that would never happen because we both knew it was a terrible idea. So we just didn't do it. You know what? We didn't do it. We didn't pine. We didn't think, oh, if only that one hot night we could have had. We just went, nah, we can see that the price of admission it's not going to be worth the actual event, so we're not going to do it. And we turned it into a joke and had a good laugh about it. So yeah, it absolutely can happen.
This brings us on to cringy, out of place sex scenes. And my God, do I have an example for you. So as we've previously discussed, a sex scene does not need to actually contain sex in it. No. In fact, there's a great scene in The Last Samurai, which has lots of problems onto itself, but there's a great scene where literally, rather than having clothes taken off, you have what's-his-face's character. He's being dressed in armour, but in a very tender way, and it's essentially a sex scene, but there's no actual sex taking place. The scenes that do have sex should be built up to, assuming you're not just writing erotica, in which case, different point entirely. You know, you should be building up to sex. Your book is going to be seriously unbalanced if the graphic sex scene just comes out of the blue.
And suddenly they're fucking on all the surfaces.
And it's, yeah, literally, it is going to, unless it's meant to be just sort of like, yeah, you'd have to do it in a very, very particular way. And once again, I do not mean to just drag Sarah J. Maas through the mud, because I know a lot of people really did enjoy A Court of Silver Flames and enjoyed the sex scenes in them. I found them so jarring, particularly the early sexy kind of scenes, because you'd be having these huge emotional moments, and then it's just, and then they had sexy thoughts, and I was like, no, wait, what? One of them is incredibly depressed. The other one is, like, this doesn't make sense. What? Why are they suddenly having these very, and then these incredibly explicit sex scenes, which just seem to come so out of left field. I couldn't understand it at all.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I would add to that the fact that they were even kind of lazy in the way they were written. And then you had the, oh, well, they're obviously going to be shagging all the time now, but I'm not necessarily interested in doing, or I can't include every single scene. So I think she literally wrote, and they fucked on every surface in the house.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, you clearly want to be writing erotica, so go away and write erotica. It's fine.
Yeah.
It can even have fairies in it. It's not proper.
Yeah, but I think that's the thing.
Yeah, super, super out of the place. It's not to say that every, you know, sex scene that has actual sex in it,
mm-hmm.
that needs to be emotionally charged, but it shouldn't just... It's kind of like, you know, balance your sex scenes the way you balance your scenes of violence.
Mm.
A scene of violence, unless there's a specific reason for it, wouldn't just happen with no explanation afterwards or no build-up to it.
Yeah.
So it's the same with a sex scene. They're kind of in the same ballpark.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, characters who are supposed to be ordinary, living a lifestyle of a one percenter, so someone who is in the top 1% of wealth. So if you think of Sex and the City and the fact that Carrie Bradshaw, the main character, is living in New York, which is one of the most expensive places to live, and yet somehow is managing to fund this lifestyle where she has designer shoes, designer clothes, goes out to lunch all the time, doesn't seem to have a very steady job. And it's like, I'm assuming you've got great personal wealth, because how else are you doing it?
Yeah, you also always get... you get it in... It's basically always sort of romantic comedies as well, where they've got like a really unstable job and yet they have these great little penthouses or things like that. You never see them living in sort of like grotty flats or anything.
No, you don't. And, you know, it's absolutely okay if you want to write a character who is part of the millionaire class. That's fine, but we need to know that fairly early on. Or we need to know where they're getting the money from. Or we need to know that they're having, you know, they're struggling. They're having to budget like most people.
Yeah.
And if you are writing someone who is part of the 1%, then their mindset is going to be very, very different because they've never had to worry where money's coming from.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you need to bear those things in mind.
Yeah. Very much so. It does get very jarring otherwise. I should also say that, you know... On the flip side of that, you can write poverty, but poverty appears in lots of different ways.
Definitely.
It's not always you know, right, the lights are, we've got no electricity or anything like that. It really can appear in different ways, or we can't afford to have a mobile or stuff like that. It will vary. Also, yeah, particular, whether it's sort of, I don't mean chronic poverty, but whether it's we are continuously struggling for money, or there has been a circumstance which has recently made a bad situation worse, kind of thing.
Definitely. And there's also genteel poverty, whereby you can literally be living in a castle, but you can't afford the food bills.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, there's a wide spectrum there. I think the thing is to be aware that your character will have living expenses.
Yes.
And definitely needs to be able to have a way to make the rent, or, you know, be independently wealthy.
Yes. Okay, dream sequences. I love me a dream sequence. I get super excited by them. But if you do include them, they should be short and to the point, and they should actually advance the plot. Now, it is worth saying that doesn't mean that your dream sequence necessarily has to be, you know, a scene which makes complete logical sense, or which kind of literally takes the next level of the plot. You can have dreams which are nebulous and strange and just feel, you know, as part of a dream, as dreams do, which is, you know, weird. Dreams are weird. They very rarely, despite what you show in fiction, you very rarely have dreams which actually involve, you know, actual events that happened. You very rarely have flashbacks in dreams. I mean, it can happen, but it doesn't actually happen that often. So dreams can be nebulous and things along those lines. But there should be a reason why you are including those dreams, why you are showing those dreams. They should have some kind of impact which will affect the plot. That can be through the way that the character is reacting, it could be an element of foreshadowing. And remember, dreams are caused by your brain ultimately sort of processing all the information of the day, and part of that is also subconscious information. So you can actually have realistically small hints and things like that inserted into dreams. And again, if it's fiction, you have even more leeway with that.
Definitely. Okay, bilingual characters saying something in one language and then repeating it in English for their English speaking friends. I agree with this broadly, but I will say it does depend on how you do it. It is fairly normal during times of stress to let something slip in your mother tongue, particularly if it's something that was spoken around you a lot as a child. Mm. So you might suddenly go, oh shit, in Irish or whatever, because, you know, that's how it's come to you. You wouldn't then necessarily then translate that for the person you're with.
Yeah, absolutely. It's... As someone who is bilingual and who has learned other languages, I do potter around the house and just respond in other languages sometimes. That's not always conscious. It's not that I've just suddenly said, today I'm going to speak in French exclusively. It will kind of depend on sort of where my mind is at. When I was practicing a lot of Japanese, for instance, in preparation to go out there, because I was watching a lot of Japanese content, reading a lot of Japanese and doing Japanese lessons, I would find myself muttering things in Japanese as part of the practice, because that was at the forefront of my mind. So yes, if you are bilingual, and again, I will, this is the thing, I drive in French. I tend to work in English, but I drive in French. I also will tend to count in French, because it's just common practice. But then I don't translate, so I'm not driving and I don't start swearing in French and then suddenly go, oh, but for everyone else in the car, allow me to translate. It doesn't work like that. One of the best examples of this, and I don't want to go on too much of a tangent, but one of the best examples of this is actually an anime which I have mentioned, which is My Hero Academia, where one of the characters, All Might, spent a large portion of his education in America, which means that he swears in English. So he will be doing stuff, and every now and again he will come out with these English phrases, which he doesn't then translate. He just kind of, other characters can understand by the context. So every now and again, he will literally say in English, "Repeat after me." And it's very obvious that the choice phrases that he says in English are phrases that he will have heard a lot when he was in America, or phrases that would have been part of his education, or the things that people around him were saying. So he says the word shit a lot, which is very funny. But I think it works very well, and it's actually a really nice example of something being bilingual without it feeling really out of place.
Yeah, they do it in Firefly as well, yeah. Because obviously Chinese and English are now sort of, you know, everybody speaks both. Yeah. So they actually swear a lot in Chinese in that.
Yeah. No, it works very, very well. Also, I should one thing with the bilingual thing that you notice is the it's like, oh, I switched to French. I didn't even realize. Shut up. You might not actually necessarily remember which language you're speaking, but kind of that switch over, that's definitely not how being bilingual works. Being bilingual is often very much like, and then I had the thing on the feet, the thing that you put on the feet, the shoes, not the shoes, the thing underneath the shoes, the thing underneath the shoes, the soles. No, like the inside the shoes, but underneath the shoes that you put up, the, you know, like the little cloth bag you put on your, the socks. Okay, thank you. That's what being bilingual is actually like. So there you go. Right.
Yeah, I think my experience is I'm not really properly bilingual, but enough that if I happen to be thinking more sort of in another language, and then someone interrupts me, then I'll come back, and it's this big lag time between them saying something and me answering because I'm kind of fumbling for the word.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like you've got to switch between tongues.
Yeah,
absolutely. One thing we used to tease was because we have lots of bilingual friends, the question we'd always ask is, when you go to an ATM, because we would all be in other countries as well, when you go to an ATM, what language do you pick? English or French? And the funniest thing would be them, their minds clearly going totally blank because they don't remember. I'd be like, Mum, which language did you pick? And she'd be like, which language did I pick? I don't remember.
Yeah. No, I found that, and I've found it where I've been writing little bits of Irish, and afterwards I've gone, hang on a minute, I know what I've just written, but what language should I write it in? And then I'm having to open it up again to find out what.
Yeah.
So it's the weird switchover.
Yeah. Okay. So the next is too many questions in a row. You have got to be so careful when you include questions in any kind of narration or narrative. It is, you know, this is usually in a reflective paragraph, but you know, you've got to just be careful. It's like, but what was I doing there? What should I do? Why were they here? You know, if you keep continuing to have loads and loads of questions one after the other, it gets really jarring.
Yeah, I think on a broad level, you're kind of communicating with the reader that you don't know what's going on. So, you know what, in a first draft, I will have this, because I might not necessarily know exactly what's going on in that scene or why it's relevant. So you've got to
frame the questions.
But when you go back through, it's kind of like, I've answered those questions, so I'm going to change it so that it's phrased not as a question, or, you know, it's clearly the character considering a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely.
See, this is a weird one, because I do sometimes say sis when I'm talking to my sister, but basically family relationships as nicknames. Some people absolutely hate the whole bro sis thing.
Or son.
Son.
What is it, son?
I think this is one of those ones where it depends on time, place, setting, and, you know, individual family circumstances. Because, I mean, I'll say sisters very ironically. Or sisters dear kind of thing. I don't use it all the time, but I'm also not someone who goes, hey shithead, to my sisters either, because, you know, I would have seriously got smacked for that by my parents as a child, so it's kind of like not stuck.
Yeah. It's funny, because around the house I will occasionally refer to my dad as father, but it's only usually to his face. So I'll be like, father, and he'll be like, yes. And I'm like, what are you doing today, father? But I don't actually think of him as father. It's just, it's kind of meant to be part of a certain mood or a kind of an ongoing joke. And that's something you also do need to consider. And again, it will be different. It's the same kind of mood that if I said father and he turned and went daughter. And then, you know, then we're establishing yes, exactly. like a funny narrative.
It's like, my sisters and I usually say mum, but occasionally we slip and we'll say marmy, which is the Irish for mum. My mother absolutely hates us using the word ma. She's like, I'm not a sheep. Stop bleating at me. So occasionally it'll be ma'am or it'll be marmy. And she'll sort of accept that. But the minute you get into ma territory, she gets really angry.
Yeah. It will also depend what I'm doing. The great thing is that, and this is something that actually you need to be careful of when you're doing it in fiction, because in person you might have lots and lots of different names for the people around you. Whereas in fiction you want to be a little bit more consistent, unless there's, you know, like very small things. So for instance, I will also use Baba for my father as well, but that's when I'm speaking French, because it'd be very weird if I was speaking French and I said, bonjour, Dad. That sounds strange, okay? That sounds weird. It will also, depending on how I say it or what I call him, it will be a different tone that I'm trying to convey, which is just natural. In the same way that I will know how angry my parents are with me by how many syllables they insert into my name. So,
yep.
Which I've explained, my mother used to do this all the time, where she'd call me, she'd start with Madeleine! And I'd be like, okay. And then I'd hear, Madeleine! And I'd be like, all right, okay, she's getting impatient. And then when I heard, Madeleine! That's when I knew that death was coming for me on light wings. If we got to four syllables, the patience had run out. It was like a countdown. it would absolutely depend. But then you need...
It's the insertion of the middle name as well.
Yes. It's
which, you know, is when my younger sister kind of like lucked out a bit, because she and Dad couldn't entirely decide on a middle name, so she ended up with more middle names. So, you know, if you someone was annoyed with Ella, her name got progressively longer and longer.
Yeah. And you might also have nicknames within. My brother's nickname for me is Midge, and my nickname for him is Chew, and no one else in the family is really allowed. Well, some people are, but like my parents were never allowed to call me Midge, and were never allowed to call my brother Chew. That just wasn't allowed at all.
Yeah, it's like me and Ella. Ella was Weasel, and I was Ratbag. No one else is allowed to do it. We still call each other that. We try not to do it in front of her children so that they don't pick it up, because Ella doesn't want them calling me Auntie Ratbag. But yeah, it's been a thing for a long time.
Yeah, but you do want to be a little bit more consistent in fiction, because the last thing you want is to cause confusion for your readers. So you might have one character giving others a particular nickname, but then try to be consistent with it. So for example, Kestrel. Kestrel's queen of nicknames, because she has no respect for anybody. So she gives everybody a nickname, and then she's quite consistent with that nickname. So within Kestrel, Galahad, is she calls him Centurion every now and again. She calls Shaylin Princess every now and again. And she calls Nessic Lestrade. But then it's consistent. If it was Kestrel in real life, she would have a multitude of different nicknames, a multitude of different things that she'd be doing. But that would start to get confusing, particularly in a narrative where everything's in first person, so she's thinking about them. So you've got to kind of balance between what happens in real life with what actually happens on page.
Definitely. There's also a class component as well. Yeah. So certainly in Britain, the upper classes, generally you'll find the children still refer to their parents as mummy and daddy.
Yes.
Although most of us kind of like shorten that to mum and dad.
Yeah.
Sort of at a fairly early age, because it's sort of babyish to say mummy and daddy, but not if you're in the upper classes.
Yeah. And then, of course, the problem is the word daddy takes on a different connotation.
Yeah, a lot of that's come from America.
Yeah, I
I
know.
reject these things that have been ported back from America.
It's that moment in Brooklyn Nine-Nine where they're trying to get into a club and Jake Peralta pretends to call. He's like, "I'm calling Daddy." And he's like, "They won't let us in, Daddy. Daddy. Ooh, Daddy." He's suddenly like, "Wait, what's he portraying here? It's really difficult to tell." So yeah, that's worth considering, definitely.
Okay, we've just got a few more. We're going to whiz through the next couple because hopefully people are not going to need too much
Yeah.
explanation. But over explaining what a look means. Now, someone can give you a defensive look or they can give you an angry look, whatever. But if you're kind of like that, he gave me a look where his eyes blazed with the fury of a thousand suns, blah 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 blah, and then you add in several other emotions as well. It's kind of like he was looking at you for like 5 seconds. Are you seriously telling me you got all that from him?
Yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah, so just be careful with that one. Also, using impossibly or literally incorrectly.
It's
I'm
like,
so guilty of this.
she was standing impossibly close. Well, if she was standing that close, it wasn't impossible, was it? So,
She was standing.
yeah. Oh,
She was
there's a
in my
certain.
skin.
She was impossible. Yeah, then you're kind of like impossibly. I think the thing is, you can do this in a metaphorical way, and it can work really well.
Yeah.
But when you're using impossibly or literally all the time,
Yeah.
and you're not really thinking about what the word actually means, then it becomes an issue.
Yeah. Then you have the breath that he didn't know he was holding.
Yeah.
I've never actually known. Well, okay, actually, that's a lie. I have had like one experience when I didn't realize I was holding my breath. Or rather, it wasn't that I was holding my breath. It wasn't that I breathed in and then was neglecting to breathe out. I literally had just stopped breathing. And it only happened for a very short period of time when I suddenly went, "Oh," and breathed in. That was once in my entire life. It's very rare.
Yeah, it's not. I think the problem is that this has been a sentence that's used so much that it's become a cliche unto itself. And now people are kind of like, now they've seen it, they can't stop seeing it. Another one that people have said is somewhere a dog barked. Well, I think that's a ridiculous thing to get really upset about because by and large, many, many people have dogs as pets. So the chances are a dog will bark somewhere during the
Yeah.
night. So that's a weird one to get bent out of shape about. But a breath he didn't know he's holding. You can do this in a different way. You can say he drew a he drew, have the dialogue end, and he relaxed, his shoulders came down, and he drew a deep breath, kind of thing, almost
Yeah,
as if
or
sort of like there'd been an interruption.
he drew a shaky breath or,
Yeah.
something like that. You can show lots in that way without using overused sort of descriptions or clichés.
Yeah. Too many pop culture references.
These will date your work.
Yeah, for they can date your work. There are classics that come around again and again, and if your character's actually doing something like watching a film or reading a book, then it's perfectly okay to have them sort of having a bit of a bant about it. That's not a problem. But when it's all the time, I mean, we don't need to know that the character knows who the Cardassians are. And I mean the
Yes.
Cardassians as in the family rather than the really interesting Cardassians as in Deep Space Nine. So, yeah.
Crossover I never knew I wanted. But yes, it is something to think about, because you might have a very good reason to include pop culture references, and there are some pop culture references which don't die, which have, kind of prevailed and remained and are likely to. But yeah, it's definitely worth thinking about, and particularly how much of your humor or how much, of an exchange relies upon the understanding of that pop culture reference is going to affect how well your work continues and may end up aging it. So it's
Yeah.
definitely something to consider, but you don't have to take them out entirely.
Basically, if something has managed to last for 20 years prior to you writing the reference, chances are it's going to last a bit longer, so you're probably okay with that one, but try not to pep your work with it.
So the next one is awkward physical movements and body parts moving independently. Okay, so do they need to roll their eyes or smirk all the time? I mean, people do roll their eyes and they do smirk, but people don't roll their eyes that often. Then there's and this. I know this one is a pet peeve for Jules. It's his eyes danced.
Well, his eyes roved around the room. It's like, no, they didn't, because
No,
if
they
you think
didn't.
about that literally, his eyes climbed the length of her legs. Really? What are they on tentacles? What the hell? What's he doing? What's the rest of his body doing?
Screaming. She's screaming. Everybody's screaming. Yeah, unless of course you literally have a body part which has come to life and is acting of its own, volition because of some sort of curse. Just be very careful of this. Again, you can do things metaphorically, but be conscious of not doing it too often. Don't give the rest of their body autonomy all the time, otherwise things will get freaky real
And this
fast.
goes double for breasts. They don't have their own emotional states and weather, okay? They just
No,
don't.
they absolutely don't. Yeah, seriously.
Okay, electric moments. So if two characters have been yearning for each other for several chapters or even books, an electric moment of contact when they first, kiss or have sex would be normal. If it happens the first time they meet and accidentally brush skin and there's no more plot to it than that, then probably not.
Yeah, again, this will all really depend on the narrative that you're writing. But there should be a moment that, I mean, that's not a moment, but there should be a reason why. Perhaps, I mean, other than static, there should be a reason why there's, something sort of springs between them.
He came over to me. I met his gaze from across the room, and as he approached, our hands brushed, and he gave me a static electric
Gave me a
shock.
static electric shock.
My
Which,
hair
weirdly enough,
rose.
ow, you
At that
bugger,
moment, I think you'd think, oh, we're really incompatible. It doesn't matter what he looks like.
I want to write that now. I want to write that. Anyway. Yeah, so unless there's a reason, so like for some reason, like they're soulmates or something like that, which has meant that they've kind of touched, but then that can't just be it. It can't just be we had a moment. And the thing is that you can actually have moments with people who you never actually meet or never talk to again. I remember when I was a teenager, I had this very strange moment when I was walking to the shops. I was walking one way, there was a guy who was walking the other, and we both caught each other's eyes. And it was very, very strange because I'm definitely not one for this kind of thing, but we both caught each other's eyes and there was a weird thing and we passed each other and I took several steps and I stopped and I turned around to re-look at him because I felt like I needed to, and I turned around at the same moment that he also turned around to look at me. And we both kind of laughed and smiled and then went our separate ways. And that's the closest I've ever come to a moment with someone who I've never met before. And even though I do think of that incident with kind of a little bit of hilarity, it's not that I'm ever lying in my bed going, "My love, where did you go?
I must find him. Bring
I
me the
must
glass slipper.
find him." I cannot function. I cannot be in love with anyone. Like, no, it was a strange moment which had a weird energy to it, which I do think about from time to time, but I'm not thinking about it in terms of, I don't even remember what the guy looked like. I just remember the incident.
See, I'm now wondering if on another timeline there was kind of like a sliding doors moment and he was walking just a little bit to his right or left or whatever, and you ended up bumping into each other and that was your meet cute moment. So in another universe, you actually
Yeah.
met each other properly and got talking, whereas in this universe, you kind of like just passed each other but you felt the echo from another timeline.
Yeah, and I am totally willing to believe that. I'm totally willing to believe that. But that's other universe me. And yeah, that was a weird thing. That wasn't a usual thing. So it can happen, but that's only one thing. That's only one level.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Too much sighing. I am so guilty of this. Sighing is literally one of the words that I have to search through whenever I am working on my manuscripts. I've got to finish, and then I've got to be like, right, I've got to look for sighing and looking, because I'm so guilty of
those. Mine used to be sighing, and now it's seeming. And sometimes something genuinely does seem, but, you know, anyway, that we've talked about personal words. But yeah, the problem with sighing is, if you've got a character who is sighing all the time, it may make sense to you as the writer in the context of what you're writing at the time. But to a reader, all we see is someone who seems either exasperated, a bit of a wimp, lazy, they're irritating, or maybe they have breathing difficulties.
Yeah, maybe they need an inhaler. Yeah.
So basically, you get a character gets to sigh once every few chapters maximum.
Yeah, I mean, think of it like this: is if you're reading it and you're reading their dialogue, sigh every time they sigh. And if you find yourself kind of getting a bit lightheaded and breathless, or you feel it's excessive, so will the characters in the book, and so will your readers. So think about the sighing a little bit carefully.
Definitely. Okay, our final point today is, and I thought to myself, which is just
what a wonderful world. Sorry.
It's just the weirdest sentence, because who else would you be thinking to? Unless you literally have a telepathic character, who would you be thinking to except yourself? It's kind of like what the absolute core Christ saw in one of Amber Benson's books, I'm sorry to say, was, I thought to myself in my head. Or, I thought in my head. I'm like, where do you normally think in your kidneys? In your backyard? Is this normally an out-of-body experience for you? And, you know, this is kind of representative of things like, he shrugged his shoulders. Well, what would he normally shrug? So if you're, you know, are you using things that you don't need to use because it's already inferred in the context of what you said?
Yeah, it's also like, he grabbed at me with his hands. I wasn't thinking that he was grabbing at you with your feet. I mean, like...
No, because that would be strange enough that you'd say, he made a grab for me with one foot. It'd be kind of like, with one foot. That's weird.
In which case, yeah, that is definitely, you know, but, you know, he said with his mouth. unless you're saying, with his eyes, he said, undress for me. But with his mouth, he said, get out. You know, unless it's very specific and you actually do have to draw attention to the fact that they're physically speaking, you don't need to bring in random body parts or things like that, which are already very much obvious.
Yeah, definitely. So, in conclusion, and we have run over a bit despite our best efforts, but there are other peeves. People will have other personal ones. We've covered most of the big ones that I think lots of people agree on. And you're never going to satisfy everyone. As we've said, the point is to pay attention to your own writing. Avoid the urge to over-explain. So you should already know what's happening from how you've written a sentence, ideally. And try and avoid a repetition without purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and as I mentioned earlier, I'm actually going to recommend this docudrama, which is Age of Samurai: Battle for Japan. It's found on Netflix. It's a couple of years old, but it's very, very good. It basically gives a history of Japan from around the 1500s, and basically talks about the sort of the unification of Japan from with all of the daimyo, and the, you know, the creation of what would become the samurai class. Incredibly interesting, really good insight into history, not for the faint of heart. There is a lot of blood and guts and murder in it, with some reenactments. So if that's something that's not your, you know, cup of tea, I'd avoid it. But very well acted, very well narrated, some really good experts coming in to give their opinions. Very enjoyable. Very interesting if you want to learn a little bit about Japanese history. So that's my recommendation for the week.
Okay, that sounds great. And it does look very good. I sort of eyeballed it. My eyes eyeballed it on Netflix. I eyeballed it with my eyes.
With your eyes, which climbed out of the skull. Anyway, speaking of eyeballs, yeah, that's one thing to warn about with the docuseries. Someone does literally remove their eye in front of us. It's not too graphic, but, you know, it's still there. With that in mind, We would love to hear from you. What do you think? What are some of your pet peeves with writing? What are you guilty of? Being aware of it is one of the first steps to correcting it. Let us know. Remember, you can get in touch with us via our Facebook, Tumblr, or Twitter, both individually or through the Dissecting Dragons pages. For now, we'll say thanks so much for listening, guys. Stay safe, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.